but my father had awakened and grabbed my aggressor. Too weak to overwhelm him, he thought of calling Mayor Katz. "Come, come quickly, someone is strangling my son." In a few moments, I was freed. I never did find out why the stranger had wanted to strangle me. But days later, Mayor Katz told my father, "Shlomo, I am getting weak. My strength is gone. I won't make it." "Don't give in," my father tried to encourage him. "You must resist. Don't lose faith in yourself." But Mayor Katz only groaned in response. "I can't go on, Shlomo. I can't help it. I can't go on." My father took his arm, and Mayor Katz, the strong one, the sturdiest of us all, began to cry. His son had been taken from him during the first selection, but only now was he crying for him. Only now did he fall apart. He could not go on. He had reached the end. On the last day of our journey, a terrible wind began to blow, and the snow kept falling. We sensed that the end was near, the real end. We could not hold out long in this glacial wind, this storm. Somebody got up and yelled, "We must not remain sitting. We shall freeze to death. Let's get up and move." We all got up. We all pulled our soaked blankets tighter around our shoulders. And we tried to take a few steps to shuffle back and forth in place. Suddenly, a cry rose in the wagon, the cry of a wounded animal. Someone had just died. Others, close to death, imitated his cry, and their cries seemed to come from beyond the grave. Soon, everybody was crying, groaning, moaning, cries of distress hurled into the wind and the snow. The lament spread from wagon to wagon. It was contagious. And now hundreds of cries rose at once, the death rattle of an entire convoy with the end approaching. All boundaries had been crossed. Nobody had any strength left, and the night seemed endless. Mayor Katz was moaning, "Why don't they just shoot us now?" That same night, we reached our destination. It was late. The guards came to unload us. The dead were left in the wagons. Only those who could stand could leave. Mayor Katz remained on the train. The last day had been the most lethal. We had been 100 or so in this wagon. 12 of us left it, among them my father and myself. We had arrived in Buchenwald. At the entrance to the camp, SS officers were waiting for us. We were counted. Then we were directed to the Appelplatz. The orders were given over the loudspeakers. Form ranks of fives, groups of 100, 5 steps forward. I tightened my grip on my father's hand, the old familiar fear not to lose him. Very close to us stood the tall chimney of the crematorium's furnace. It no longer impressed us. It barely drew our attention. A veteran of Buchenwald told us that we would be taking a shower and afterward be sent to different blocks. The idea of a hot shower fascinated me. My father didn't say a word. He was breathing heavily beside me. "Father," I said, "just another moment. Soon we'll be able to lie down. You'll be able to rest." He didn't answer. I myself was so weary that his silence left me indifferent. My only wish was to take the shower as soon as possible and lie down on a cot. Only it wasn't easy to reach the showers. Hundreds of prisoners crowded the area. The guards seemed unable to restore order. They were lashing out left and right to no avail. Some prisoners who didn't have the strength to jostle or even to stand sat down in the snow. My father wanted to do the same. He was moaning, "I can't anymore. It's over. I shall die right here." He dragged me toward a pile of snow from which protruded human shapes, torn blankets,
Leave me, he said. I can't go on any more. Have pity on me. I'll wait here until we can go into the showers. You'll come and get me.
I could have screamed in anger. To have lived and endured so much, was I going to let my father die now? Now that we would be able to take a good hot shower and lie down? Father, I howled, Father, get up right now. You will kill yourself. And I grabbed his arm. He continued to moan.
Don't yell, my son. Have pity on your old father. Let me rest here a little. I beg of you. I'm so tired. No more strength.
He had become childlike, weak, frightened, vulnerable. Father, I said, you cannot stay here. I pointed to the corpses around him. They too had wanted to rest here.
I see, my son, I do see them. Let them sleep. They haven't closed an eye for so long. They're exhausted, exhausted.
His voice was tender. I howled into the wind.
They're dead. They will never wake up, never. Do you understand?
This discussion continued for some time. I knew that I was no longer arguing with him, but with death itself, with death that he had already chosen. The sirens began to wail, alert. The lights went out in the entire camp. The guards chased us toward the blocks. In a flash, there was no one left outside. We were only too glad not to have to stay outside any longer in the freezing wind. We let ourselves sink into the floor. The cauldrons at the entrance found no takers. There were several tiers of bunks. To sleep was all that mattered. When I woke up, it was daylight. That is when I remembered that I had a father. During the alert, I had followed the mob, not taking care of him. I knew he was running out of strength, close to death, and yet I had abandoned him. I went to look for him. Yet at the same time, a thought crept into my mind. If only I didn't find him. If only I were relieved of this responsibility, I could use all my strength to fight for my own survival, to take care only of myself. Instantly, I felt ashamed. Ashamed of myself. Forever. I walked for hours without finding him. Then I came to a block where they were distributing black coffee. People stood in line, quarreled. A plaintive voice came from behind me.
Eliezer, my son, bring me a little coffee.
I ran toward him. Father, I've been looking for you for so long. Where were you? Did you sleep? How are you feeling? He seemed to be burning with fever. I fought my way to the coffee cauldron like a wild beast, and I succeeded in bringing back a cup. I took one gulp. The rest was for him. I shall never forget the gratitude that shone in his eyes when he swallowed this beverage. The gratitude of a wounded animal. With these few mouthfuls of hot water, I had probably given him more satisfaction than during my entire childhood. He was lying on the boards, ashen, his lips pale and dry, shivering. I couldn't stay with him any longer. We had been ordered to go outside to allow for cleaning of the blocks. Only the sick could remain inside. We stayed outside for 5 hours. We were given soup. When they allowed us to return to the blocks, I rushed toward my father. Did you eat?
No.
Why?
They didn't give us anything. They said that we were sick, that we would die soon, and that it would be a waste of food. I can't go on.
I gave him what was left of my soup. But my heart was heavy. I was aware that I was doing it grudgingly. Just like Rabbi Eliyahu's son, I had not passed the test. Every day my father was getting weaker. His eyes were watery, his face the color of dead leaves. On the third day after we arrived in Buchenwald, everybody had to go to the showers, even the sick who were instructed to go last. When we returned from the showers, we had to wait outside a long time. The cleaning of the blocks had not been completed. From afar, I saw my father and ran to meet him. He went by me like a shadow, passing me without stopping, without a glance. I called to him. He did not turn around. I ran after him. "Father, where are you running?" He looked at me for a moment, and his gaze was distant, otherworldly, the face of a stranger. It lasted only a moment, and then he ran away. Suffering from dysentery, my father was prostrate on his cot, with another 5 sick inmates nearby. I sat next to him, watching him. I no longer dared to believe that he could still elude death. I did all I could to give him hope. All of a sudden, he sat up and placed his feverish lips against my ear.
"Eliezer, I must tell you where I buried the gold and silver. In the cellar, you know?"
And he began talking, faster and faster, afraid of running out of time before he could tell me everything. I tried to tell him that it was not over yet, that we would be going home together. But he no longer wanted to listen to me. He could no longer listen to me. He was worn out. Saliva mixed with blood was trickling from his lips. He had closed his eyes. He was gasping more than breathing. For a ration of bread, I was able to exchange cots to be next to my father. When the doctor arrived in the afternoon, I went to tell him that my father was very ill. "Bring him here." I explained that he could not stand up, but the doctor would not listen, and so, with great difficulty, I brought my father to him. He stared at him, then asked curtly, "What do you want?" "My father is sick," I answered in his place. "Dysentery."
"That's not my business. I'm a surgeon. Go on, make room for the others."
My protests were in vain.
"I can't go on, my son. Take me back to my bunk."
I took him back and helped him lie down. He was shivering. "Try to get some sleep, father. Try to fall asleep." His breathing was labored. His eyes were closed. But I was convinced that he was seeing everything, that he was seeing the truth in all things. Another doctor came to the block. My father refused to get up. He knew that it would be of no use. In fact, that doctor had come only to finish off the patients. I listened to him shouting at them that they were lazy good-for-nothings who only wanted to stay in bed. I considered jumping him, strangling him. But I had neither the courage nor the strength. I was riveted to my father's agony. My hands were aching. I was clenching them so hard to strangle the doctor and the others, to set the whole world on fire. My father's murderers. But even the cry stuck in my throat. On my return from the bread distribution, I found my father crying like a child.
"My son, they are beating me."
"Who?" I thought he was delirious.
"Him, the Frenchman, and the Pole, they beat me."
One more stab to the heart. One more reason to hate. One less reason to live.
"Eliezer, Eliezer, tell them not to beat me. I haven't done anything. Why are they beating me?"
I began to insult his neighbors. They mocked me. I promised them bread, soup. They laughed. Then they got angry. They could not stand my father any longer, they said, because he no longer was able to drag himself outside to relieve himself. The following day, he complained that they had taken his ration of bread. "While you were asleep?"
"No, I wasn't asleep. They threw themselves on me. They snatched it from me, my bread. And they beat me again. I can't go on, my son. Give me some water.
I knew that he must not drink. But he pleaded with me so long that I gave in. Water was the worst poison for him, but what else could I do for him? With or without water? It would be over soon, anyway.
You, at least, have pity on me.
Have pity on him?
I, his only son.
A week went by like that. "Is this your father?" asked the block eldest. "Yes. He is very sick. The doctor won't do anything for him." He looked me straight in the eye. "The doctor cannot do anything more for him, and neither can you." He placed his big hairy hand on my shoulder and added, "Listen to me, kid. Don't forget that you are in a concentration camp. In this place, it is every man for himself, and you cannot think of others, not even your father. In this place, there is no such thing as father, brother, friend. Each of us lives and dies alone. Let me give you good advice. Stop giving your ration of bread and soup to your old father. You cannot help him anymore. And you're hurting yourself. In fact, you should be getting his rations." I listened to him without interrupting. He was right, I thought, deep down, not daring to admit it to myself. Too late to save your old father. You could have 2 rations of bread, 2 rations of soup. It was only a fraction of a second, but it left me feeling guilty. I ran to get some soup and brought it to my father. But he didn't want it. All he wanted was water.
"Don't drink water. Eat the soup. I'm burning up. Why are you so mean to me, my son? Water."
I brought him water. Then I left the block for roll call. But I quickly turned back. I lay down on the upper bunk. The sick were allowed to stay in the block, so I would be sick. I didn't want to leave my father. All around me there was silence now, broken only by moaning. In front of the block, the SS were giving orders. An officer passed between the bunks. My father was pleading,
"My son, water. I'm burning up. My insides."
"Silence over there," barked the officer.
"Eliezer," continued my father, "water."
The officer came closer and shouted to him to be silent. But my father did not hear. He continued to call me. The officer wielded his club and dealt him a violent blow to the head. I didn't move. I was afraid. My body was afraid of another blow, this time to my head. My father groaned once more. I heard,
"Eliezer."
I could see that he was still breathing in gasps. I didn't move. When I came down from my bunk after roll call, I could see his lips trembling. He was murmuring something. I remained more than an hour leaning over him, looking at him, etching his bloody, broken face into my mind. Then I had to go to sleep. I climbed into my bunk above my father, who was still alive. The date was January 28th, 1945. I woke up at dawn on January 29th. On my father's cot, there lay another sick person. They must have taken him away before daybreak and taken him to the crematorium. Perhaps he was still breathing. No prayers were said over his tomb. No candle lit in his memory. His last word had been my name. He had called out to me, and I had not answered. I did not weep, and it pained me that I could not weep. But I was out of tears, and deep inside me, if I could have searched the recesses of my feeble conscience, I might have found Something like free at last. I remained in Buchenwald until April 11th. I shall not describe my life during that period. It no longer mattered. Since my father's death, nothing mattered to me anymore. I was transferred to the children's block, where there were 600 of us. The front was coming closer. I spent my days in total idleness, with only one desire, to eat. I no longer thought of my father or my mother. From time to time, I would dream, but only about soup, an extra ration of soup. On April 5th, the wheel of history turned. It was late afternoon. We were standing inside the block, waiting for an SS to come and count us. He was late. Such lateness was unprecedented in the history of Buchenwald. Something must have happened. 2 hours later, the loudspeakers transmitted an order from the camp commandant. All Jews were to gather in the upper plots. This was the end. Hitler was about to keep his promise. The children of our block did as ordered. There was no choice. Gustav, the Blockälteste, made it clear with his club. But on our way, we met some prisoners who whispered to us, "Go back to your block. The Germans plan to shoot you. Go back and don't move." We returned to the block. On our way there, we learned that the underground resistance of the camp had made the decision not to abandon the Jews and to prevent their liquidation. As it was getting late and the confusion was great, countless Jews had been passing as non-Jews. The Lagerälteste had decided that a general roll call would take place the next day. Everybody would have to be present. The roll call took place. The Lagerkommandant announced that the Buchenwald camp would be liquidated. 10 blocks of inmates would be evacuated every day. From that moment on, there was no further distribution of bread and soup. And the evacuation began. Every day, a few thousand inmates passed the camp's gate and did not return. On April 10th, there were still some 20,000 prisoners in the camp, among them a few hundred children. It was decided to evacuate all of us at once, by evening. Afterward, they would blow up the camp. And so we were herded onto the huge upper plots in ranks of 5, waiting for the gate to open. Suddenly, the sirens began to scream. Alert! We went back to the blocks. It was too late to evacuate us that evening. The evacuation was postponed to the next day. Hunger was tormenting us. We had not eaten for nearly 6 days, except for a few stalks of grass and some potato peels found on the grounds of the kitchens. At 10 o'clock in the morning, the SS took positions throughout the camp and began to herd the last of us toward the Appelplatz. The resistance movement decided at that point to act. Armed men appeared from everywhere, bursts of gunshots, grenades exploding. We, the children, remained flat on the floor of the block. The battle did not last long. Around noon, everything was calm again. The SS had fled, and the resistance had taken charge of the camp. At 6 o'clock that afternoon, the first American tank stood at the gates of Buchenwald. Our first act as free men was to throw ourselves onto the provisions. That's all we thought about. No thought of revenge or of parents, only of bread. And even when we were no longer hungry, not one of us thought of revenge. The next day, a few of the young men ran into Weimar to bring back some potatoes and clothes and to sleep with girls. But still, no trace of revenge. 3 days after the liberation of Buchenwald, I became very ill, some form of poisoning. I was transferred to a hospital and spent 2 weeks between life and death. One day, when I was able to get up, I decided to look at myself in the mirror on the opposite wall. I had not seen myself since the ghetto. From the depths of the mirror, a corpse was contemplating me. The look in his eyes as he gazed at me has never left me.
The end. You've been listening to Night by Elie Wiesel, translated from the French by Marion Wiesel, narrated by George Guidel. This recording was directed by Natanya Johnson. This new edition of Night concludes with Elie Wiesel's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, read here by George Guidel.
Your Majesty, Your Royal Highnesses, Your Excellencies, Chairman Arvik, members of the Nobel Committee, ladies and gentlemen. Words of gratitude. First to our common Creator. This is what the Jewish tradition commands us to do. At special occasions, one is duty-bound to recite the following prayer. Baruch Ata Adonai, Shehechiyanu V'Kiyamanu V'Higiyanu Lazman Hazeh. Blessed be Thou, for giving us life, for sustaining us, and for enabling us to reach this day. Then, thank you, Chairman Arvik, for the depth of your eloquence, and for the generosity of your gesture. Thank you for building bridges between people and generations. Thank you, above all, for helping humankind make peace its most urgent and noble aspiration. I am moved, deeply moved, by your words, Chairman Arvik. And it is with a profound sense of humility that I accept the honor, the highest there is, that you have chosen to bestow upon me. I know your choice transcends my person. Do I have the right to represent the multitudes who have perished? Do I have the right to accept this great honor on their behalf? I do not. No one may speak for the dead. No one may interpret their mutilated dreams and visions. And yet I sense their presence. I always do. And at this moment more than ever. The presence of my parents, that of my little sister. The presence of my teachers, my friends, my companions. This honor belongs to all the survivors and their children, and through us, to the Jewish people with whose destiny I have always identified. I remember. It happened yesterday, or eternities ago. A young Jewish boy discovered the kingdom of night. I remember his bewilderment. I remember his anguish. It all happened so fast. The ghetto, the deportation, the sealed cattle car. The fiery altar upon which the history of our people and the future of mankind were meant to be sacrificed. I remember he asked his father, "Can this be true? This is the 20th century, not the Middle Ages. Who would allow such crimes to be committed? How could the world remain silent?" And now the boy is turning to me. "Tell me," he asks, "what have you done with my future? What have you done with your life?" And I tell him that I have tried. That I have tried to keep memory alive. That I have tried to fight those who would forget. Because if we forget, we are guilty. We are accomplices. And then I explain to him how naive we were. That the world did know and remained silent. And that is why I swore never to be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation. We must take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. Sometimes we must interfere. When human lives are endangered, when human dignity is in jeopardy, national borders and sensitivities become irrelevant. Wherever men and women are persecuted because of their race, religion, or political views, that place must, at that moment, become the center of the universe. Of course, since I am a Jew profoundly rooted in my people's memory and tradition, My first response is to Jewish fears, Jewish needs, Jewish crises. For I belong to a traumatized generation, one that experienced the abandonment and solitude of our people. It would be unnatural for me not to make Jewish priorities my own. Israel, Soviet Jewry, Jews in Arab lands. But others are important to me. Apartheid is, in my view, as abhorrent as anti-Semitism. To me, Andrei Sakharov's isolation is as much a disgrace as Joseph Begun's imprisonment and Ida Nudel's exile, as is the denial of solidarity and its leader Lech Wałęsa's right to dissent, and Nelson Mandela's interminable imprisonment. There is so much injustice and suffering crying out for our attention. Victims of hunger, of racism and political persecution, in Chile, for instance, or in Ethiopia. Writers and poets, prisoners in so many lands governed by the left and by the right. Human rights are being violated on every continent. More people are oppressed than free. How can one not be sensitive to their plight? Human suffering anywhere concerns men and women everywhere. That applies also to Palestinians, to whose plight I am sensitive, but whose methods I deplore when they lead to violence. Violence is not the answer. Terrorism is the most dangerous of answers. They are frustrated. That is understandable. Something must be done. The refugees and their misery. The children and their fear. The uprooted and their hopelessness. Something must be done about their situation. Both the Jewish people and the Palestinian people have lost too many sons and daughters and have shed too much blood. This must stop, and all attempts to stop it must be encouraged. Israel will cooperate, I am sure of that. I trust Israel, for I have faith in the Jewish people. Let Israel be given a chance. Let hatred and danger be removed from their horizons, and there will be peace in and around the Holy Land. Please understand my deep and total commitment to Israel. If you could remember what I remember, you would understand. Israel is the only nation in the world whose existence is threatened. Should Israel lose but one war, it would mean her end and ours as well. But I have faith. Faith in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and even in his creation. Without it, no action would be possible. And action is the only remedy to indifference, the most insidious danger of all. Isn't that the meaning of Alfred Nobel's legacy? Wasn't his fear of war a shield against war? There is so much to be done. There is so much that can be done. One person, a Raoul Wallenberg, an Albert Schweitzer, a Martin Luther King Jr., one person of integrity can make a difference of life and death. As long as one dissident is in prison, our freedom will not be true. As long as one child is hungry, our life will be filled with anguish and shame. What all these victims need above all is to know that they are not alone, that we are not forgetting them, that when their voices are stifled, we shall lend them ours, that while their freedom depends on ours, the quality of our freedom depends on theirs. This is what I say to the young Jewish boy wondering what I have done with his years. It is in his name that I speak to you, and that I express to you my deepest gratitude as one who has emerged from the kingdom of night. We know that every moment is a moment of grace, every hour an offering. Not to share them would mean to betray them. Our lives no longer belong to us alone. They belong to all those who need us desperately. Thank you, Chairman Arvik. Thank you, members of the Nobel Committee. Thank you, people of Norway, for declaring on this singular occasion that our survival has meaning for mankind.
That was Elie Wiesel's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, given in Oslo on December 10, 1986. Upon the publication of this new translation, Elie Wiesel wrote the following preface to the print edition.
If in my lifetime I was to write only one book, this would be the one. Just as the past lingers in the present, all my writings after night, including those that deal with biblical, Talmudic, or Hasidic themes, profoundly bear its stamp, and cannot be understood if one has not read this very first of my works. Why did I write it? Did I write it so as not to go mad? Or, on the contrary, to go mad in order to understand the nature of madness, the immense, terrifying madness that had erupted in history and in the conscience of mankind? Was it to leave behind a legacy of words, of memories, to help prevent history from repeating itself? Or was it simply to preserve a record of the ordeal I endured as an adolescent, at an age when one's knowledge of death and evil should be limited to what one discovers in literature? There are those who tell me that I survived in order to write this text. I am not convinced. I don't know how I survived. I was weak, rather shy. I did nothing to save myself. A miracle? Certainly not. If heaven could or would perform a miracle for me, why not for others more deserving than myself? It was nothing more than chance. However, having survived, I needed to give some meaning to my survival. Was it to protect that meaning that I set to paper an experience in which nothing made any sense? In retrospect, I must confess that I do not know, or no longer know, what I wanted to achieve with my words. I only know that without this testimony, my life as a writer, or my life period, would not have become what it is, that of a witness who believes he has a moral obligation to try to prevent the enemy from enjoying one last victory by allowing his crimes to be erased from human memory. For today, thanks to recently discovered documents, the evidence shows that in the early days of their accession to power, the Nazis in Germany set out to build a society in which there simply would be no room for Jews. Toward the end of their reign, their goal changed. They decided to leave behind a world in ruins in which Jews would seem never to have existed. That is why everywhere in Russia, in the Ukraine and in Lithuania, the Einsatzgruppen carried out the final solution by turning their machine guns on more than 1 million Jews, men, women, and children, and throwing them into huge mass graves, dug just moments before by the victims themselves. Special units would then disinter the corpses and burn them. Thus, for the first time in history, Jews were not only killed twice, but denied burial in a cemetery. It is obvious that the war which Hitler and his accomplices waged was a war not only against Jewish men, women, and children, but also against Jewish religion, Jewish culture, Jewish tradition, therefore Jewish memory. Convinced that this period in history would be judged one day, I knew that I must bear witness. I also knew that while I had many things to say, I did not have the words to say them. Painfully aware of my limitations, I watched helplessly as language became an obstacle. It became clear that it would be necessary to invent a new language. But how was one to rehabilitate and transform words betrayed and perverted by the enemy? Hunger, thirst, fear, transport, selection, fire, chimney. These words all have intrinsic meaning. But in those times, they meant something else. Writing in my mother tongue, at that point close to extinction, I would pause at every sentence and start over and over again. I would conjure up other verbs, other images, other silent cries. It still was not right. But what exactly was it? It was something elusive, darkly shrouded for fear of being usurped, profaned. All the dictionary had to offer seemed meager, pale, lifeless. Was there a way to describe the last journey in sealed cattle cars, the last voyage toward the unknown? Or the discovery of a demented and glacial universe where to be inhuman was human? Where disciplined, educated men in uniform came to kill, and innocent children and weary old men came to die? Or the countless separations on a single fiery night, the tearing apart of entire families, entire communities? Or, incredibly, the vanishing of a beautiful, well-behaved little Jewish girl with golden hair and a sad smile, murdered with her mother the very night of their arrival? How was one to speak of them without trembling and a heart broken for all eternity? Deep down, the witness knew then, as he does now, that his testimony would not be received. After all, it deals with an event that sprang from the darkest zone of man. Only those who experienced Auschwitz know what it was. Others will never know. But would they at least understand? Could men and women who consider it normal to assist the weak, to heal the sick, to protect small children and to respect the wisdom of their elders, understand what happened there? Would they be able to comprehend how, within that cursed universe, the masters tortured the weak and massacred the children, the sick and the old? And yet, having lived through this experience, one could not keep silent, no matter how difficult, if not impossible, it was to speak. And so I persevered, and trusted the silence that envelops and transcends words. Knowing all the while that any one of the fields of ashes in Birkenau carry more weight than all the testimonies about Birkenau. For despite all my attempts to articulate the unspeakable, it is still not right. Is that why my manuscript, written in Yiddish as "And the World Remained Silent," and translated first into French, then into English, was rejected by every major publisher, French and American, despite the tireless efforts of the great Catholic French writer and Nobel laureate François Mauriac. After months and months of personal visits, letters and telephone calls, he finally succeeded in getting it into print. Though I made numerous cuts, the original Yiddish version still was long. Jérôme Lindon, the legendary head of the small but prestigious Édition de Minuit, edited and further cut the French version. I accepted his decision because I worried that some things might be superfluous. Substance alone mattered. I was more afraid of having said too much than too little. Example: in the Yiddish version, the narrative opens with these cynical musings. In the beginning, there was faith, which is childish, trust, which is vain, and illusion, which is dangerous. We believed in God, trusted in man, and lived with the illusion that every one of us has been entrusted with a sacred spark from the Shekhinah's flame, that every one of us carries in his eyes and in his soul a reflection of God's image. That was the source, if not the cause, of all our ordeals. Other passages from the original Yiddish text had more on the death of my father and on the liberation. Why not include those in this new translation? Too personal, too private, perhaps. They need to remain between the lines. And yet, I remember that night, the most horrendous of my life. Eliezer, my son, come here. I want to tell you something, only to you. Come, don't leave me alone, Eliezer. I heard his voice, grasped the meaning of his words and the tragic dimension of the moment, yet I did not move. It had been his last wish, to have me next to him in his agony, at the moment when his soul was tearing itself from his lacerated body. Yet I did not let him have his wish. I was afraid. Afraid of the blows. That was why I remained deaf to his cries. Instead of sacrificing my miserable life and rushing to his side, taking his hand, reassuring him, showing him that he was not abandoned, that I was near him, that I felt his sorrow, instead of all that, I remained flat on my back, asking God to make my father stop calling my name, to make him stop crying. So afraid was I to incur the wrath of the SS. In fact, my father was no longer conscious. Yet his plaintive, harrowing voice went on, piercing the silence and calling me. Nobody but me. Well, the SS had flown into a rage and was striking my father on the head. Be quiet, old man, be quiet! My father no longer felt the club's blows. I did. And yet I did not react. I let the SS beat my father. I left him alone in the clutches of death. Worse, I was angry with him for having been noisy, for having cried, for provoking the wrath of the SS. Eliezer, Eliezer, come, don't leave me alone. His voice had reached me from so far away, from so close. But I had not moved. I shall never forgive myself. Nor shall I ever forgive the world for having pushed me against the wall, for having turned me into a stranger, for having awakened in me the basest, most primitive instincts. His last word had been my name, a summons, and I had not responded. In the Yiddish version, the narrative does not end with the image in the mirror, but with a gloomy meditation on the present. And now, scarcely 10 years after Buchenwald, I realize that the world forgets quickly. Today, Germany is a sovereign state. The German army has been resuscitated. Ilse Koch, the notorious sadistic monster of Buchenwald, was allowed to have children and live happily ever after. War criminals stroll through the streets of Hamburg and Munich. The past seems to have been erased, relegated to oblivion. Today there are anti-Semites in Germany, France, and even the United States who tell the world that the story of 6 million assassinated Jews is nothing but a hoax, and many people, not knowing any better, may well believe them, if not today, then tomorrow, or the day after. I am not so naive as to believe that this slim volume will change the course of history or shake the conscience of the world. Books no longer have the power they once did. Those who kept silent yesterday will remain silent tomorrow. The reader would be entitled to ask, why this new translation, since the earlier one has been around for 45 years? If it is not faithful or not good enough, why did I wait so long to replace it with one better and closer to the original? In response, I would say only that back then, I was an unknown writer who was just getting started. My English was far from good. When my British publisher told me that he had found a translator, I was pleased. I later read the translation, and it seemed all right. I never reread it. Since then, many of my other works have been translated by Marion, my wife, who knows my voice and how to transmit it better than anyone else. I am fortunate. When Pharaoh Strauss and Giroux asked her to prepare a new translation, she accepted. I am convinced that the readers will appreciate her work. In fact, as a result of her rigorous editing, I was able to correct and revise a number of important details. And so, as I reread this text written so long ago, I am glad that I did not wait any longer. And yet I still wonder, have I used the right words? I speak of my first night over there. The discovery of the reality inside the barbed wire. The warnings of a veteran inmate counseling my father and myself to lie about our ages. My father was to make himself younger and I older. The selection. The march toward the chimneys looming in the distance under an indifferent sky. The infants thrown into fiery ditches. I did not say that they were alive, but that was what I thought. But then I convinced myself, no, they were dead, otherwise I surely would have lost my mind. And yet fellow inmates also saw them. They were alive when they were thrown into the flames. Historians, among them Telford Taylor, confirmed it. And yet somehow I did not lose my mind. Before concluding this introduction, I believe it important to emphasize how strongly I feel that books, just like people, have a destiny. Some invite sorrow, others joy, some both. Earlier, I described the difficulties encountered by Night before its publication in French 47 years ago. Despite overwhelmingly favorable reviews, the book sold poorly. The subject was considered morbid and interested no one. If a rabbi happened to mention the book in his sermon, there were always people ready to complain that it was senseless to burden our children with the tragedies of the Jewish past. Since then, much has changed. Night has been received in ways that I never expected. Today, students in high schools and colleges in the United States and elsewhere read it as part of their curriculum. How to explain this phenomenon? First of all, there has been a powerful change in the public's attitude. In the 50s and 60s, adults born before or during World War II showed a careless and patronizing indifference toward what is so inadequately called the Holocaust. That is no longer true. Back then, few publishers had the courage to publish books on that subject. Today, such works are on most book lists. The same is true in academia. Back then, few schools offered courses on the subject. Today, many do. And strangely, those courses are particularly popular. The topic of Auschwitz has become part of mainstream culture. There are films, plays, novels, international conferences, exhibitions, annual ceremonies with the participation of the nation's officialdom. The most striking example is that of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. It has received more than 22 million visitors since its inauguration in 1993. This may be because the public knows that the number of survivors is shrinking daily and is fascinated by the idea of sharing memories that will soon be lost. For in the end, it is all about memory, its sources and its magnitude, and, of course, its consequences. For the survivor who chooses to testify, it is clear. His duty is to bear witness for the dead and for the living. He has no right to deprive future generations of a past that belongs to our collective memory. To forget would be not only dangerous, but offensive. To forget the dead would be akin to killing them a second time. Sometimes I am asked if I know the response to Auschwitz. I answer that not only do I not know it, but that I don't even know if a tragedy of this magnitude has a response. What I do know is that there is response in responsibility. When we speak of this era of evil and darkness, so close and yet so distant, responsibility is the key word. The witness has forced himself to testify. For the youth of today, for the children who will be born tomorrow, he does not want his past to become their future.
That was Elie Wiesel on this new translation of Night, translated from the French by Marion Wiesel. We would like to conclude this program with the following essay by François Mauriac.
Foreign journalists frequently come to see me. I am wary of them. torn as I am between my desire to speak to them freely and the fear of putting weapons into the hands of interviewers whose attitude toward France I do not know. During these encounters, I tend to be on my guard. That particular morning, the young Jew who came to interview me on behalf of a Tel Aviv daily won me over from the first moment. Our conversation very quickly became more personal. Soon I was sharing with him memories from the time of the occupation. It is not always the events that have touched us personally that affect us the most. I confided to my young visitor that nothing I had witnessed during that dark period had marked me as deeply as the image of cattle cars filled with Jewish children at the Austerlitz train station. Yet I did not even see them with my own eyes. It was my wife who described them to me, still under the shock of the horror she had felt. At that time we knew nothing about the Nazis' extermination methods, and who could have imagined such things? But these lambs, torn from their mothers, that was an outrage far beyond anything we had thought possible. I believe that on that day I first became aware of the mystery of the iniquity whose exposure marked the end of an era and the beginning of another. The dream conceived by Western man in the 18th century, whose dawn he thought he had glimpsed in 1789, and which, until August 2, 1914, had become stronger with the advent of the Enlightenment and scientific discoveries, that dream finally vanished for me before those trainloads of small children. And yet, I was still thousands of miles away from imagining that these children were destined to feed the gas chambers and crematoria. This, then, was what I probably told this journalist, and when I said with a sigh, "I have thought of these children so many times," he told me, "I was one of them." He was one of them. He had seen his mother, a beloved little sister, and most of his family, except his father and two other sisters, disappear in a furnace fueled by living creatures. As for his father, the boy had to witness his martyrdom day after day, and finally his agony and death, and what a death! The circumstances of it are narrated in this book, and I shall allow readers, who should be as numerous as those reading the diary of Anne Frank, to discover them for themselves, as well as by what miracle the child himself escaped. I maintain, therefore, that this personal record, coming as it does after so many others and describing an abomination such as we might have thought no longer had any secrets for us, is different, distinct, and unique, nevertheless. The fate of the Jews of the small town in Transylvania called Sieget, their blindness as they confronted a destiny from which they would have still had time to flee, the inconceivable passivity with which they surrendered to it, deaf to the warnings and pleas of a witness, who, having escaped the massacre, relates to them what he has seen with his own eyes, but they refuse to believe him and call him a madman. This set of circumstances would surely have sufficed to inspire a book to which, I believe, no other can be compared. It is, however, another aspect of this extraordinary book that has held my attention. The child who tells us his story here was one of God's chosen. From the time he began to think, he lived only for God, studying the Talmud, eager to be initiated into the Kabbalah, wholly dedicated to the Almighty. Have we ever considered the consequence of a less visible, less striking abomination? Yet the worst of all, for those of us who have faith, the death of God in the soul of a child who suddenly faces absolute evil? Let us try to imagine what goes on in his mind as his eyes watch rings of black smoke unfurl in the sky, smoke that emanates from the furnaces into which his little sister and his mother have been thrown after thousands of other victims. Never shall I forget that night. The first night in camp that turned my life into one long night 7 times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the small faces of the children whose bodies I saw transformed into smoke under a silent sky. Never shall I forget those flames that consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget the nocturnal silence that deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments that murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to ashes. Never shall I forget those things, even were I condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. It was then that I understood what had first appealed to me about this young Jew. The gaze of a Lazarus risen from the dead, yet still held captive in the somber regions into which he had strayed, stumbling over desecrated corpses. For him, Nietzsche's cry articulated an almost physical reality. God is dead, the God of love, of gentleness and consolation, the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob had, under the watchful gaze of this child, vanished forever into the smoke of the human holocaust demanded by the race, the most voracious of all idols. And how many devout Jews endured such a death? On that most horrible day, even among all those other bad days, when the child witnessed the hanging, yes, of another child, who, he tells us, had the face of a sad angel, he heard someone behind him groan, "For God's sake, where is God?" And from within me I heard a voice answer, "Where he is, this is where, hanging here from this gallows." On the last day of the Jewish year, the child is present at the solemn ceremony of Rosh Hashanah. He hears thousands of slaves cry out in unison, "Blessed be the Almighty." Not so long ago, he too would have knelt down, and with such worship, such awe, such love, but this day, he does not kneel. He stands. The human creature, humiliated and offended in ways that are inconceivable to the mind or the heart, defies the blind and deaf divinity. "I no longer pleaded for anything. I was no longer able to lament. On the contrary, I felt very strong. I was the accuser, God the accused. My eyes had opened and I was alone, terribly alone in a world without God, without man, without love or mercy. I was nothing but ashes now, but I felt myself to be stronger than this Almighty to whom my life had been bound for so long. In the midst of these men assembled for prayer, I felt like an observer, a stranger. And I, who believe that God is love, what answer was there to give my young interlocutor, whose dark eyes still held the reflection of the angelic sadness that had appeared one day on the face of a hanged child? What did I say to him? Did I speak to him of that other Jew, this crucified brother who perhaps resembled him and whose cross conquered the world? Did I explain to him that what had been a stumbling block for his faith had become a cornerstone for mine, and that the connection between the cross and human suffering remains, in my view, the key to the unfathomable mystery in which the faith of his childhood was lost? And yet Zion has risen up again out of the crematoria and the slaughterhouses. The Jewish nation has been resurrected from among its thousands of dead. It is they who have given it new life. We do not know the worth of one single drop of blood, one single tear. All is grace. If the Almighty is the Almighty, the last word for each of us belongs to him. That is what I should have said to the Jewish child. But all I could do was embrace him and weep.
That was an essay by François Mauriac on Elie Wiesel's Night. This essay was originally included as a foreword to the print edition of this book.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.